Hello, listeners. Two quick notices. Rhiannon Evans and I will be recording a live episode of the Emperors of Rome podcast at the Melbourne Museum on 4th of August. You can get tickets from their website. Secondly, Emperors of Rome is an independent, listener-supported podcast. Consider giving your support on Patreon. One perk that's available to members is special exclusive bonus episodes. We recently looked at the other potential heirs of Julius Caesar. There'll be a clip of that at the end of this episode. To find out more, you can go to patreon.com/Rome Podcast. Thanks. Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me, as always, is Dr. Rhiannon Evans. This is episode CCLVIII, The Rise of Octavian. When Octavius was a child, a distant but important male relative came into prominence and power. His great uncle, Julius Caesar, a war hero and eventual dictator, had no direct heirs himself. In Octavius, he saw somebody who could inherit it all, for everything the light touched was his kingdom. Here's Rhiannon Evans.
So Artia, after the death of her husband, she's in a position where she's now in charge of two, well, in the case of Octavius, the younger, very young children. As a widow, she potentially has a bit more freedom and she's reasonably well off. She's from a very elite family, but this also puts her in the position of being a desirable person for someone else to marry. Now, it may be that she wanted to remarry. She may well have wanted to be a wife again. She does remarry. It's impossible for us to tell whether pressure was put on her by her family or this was her desire. But either way, normally Roman women, especially if they are still of childbearing age, will expect to be married off, especially from her elite status. It's very unusual for a woman to remain widowed. There are some famous cases like Cornelia, but they're famous because they're unusual. So she does remarry. That was a long way of saying that. And her second husband is Lucius Marcius Philippus, who is, he's a senator. He's been consul before, so absolutely from her stratosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And it means that Octavius, the young boy, is now in a second well-connected household. So, you know, he's in a household with two people who born from that place. They're in that place already, that senatorial category. Philippus, as well as being a former consul, maybe surprisingly, given we've talked about Caesar and his family and Artia being connected to them, being traditionally connected with the more populist side of politics, Philippus very much has a foot in the optimist camp. He has been married before and he has a daughter already called Marcia. She's married to Cato the Younger. Anyone who's listened to our podcast over the years will know that he is the one who's going to be the standout against populism. He's
the
ultimate senatorial hardliner. And they were married in the year that Octavius was born in 63. She's considerably older.
Mm.
But yes, so there is that connection. And we do find this. I mean, I'm talking about it like it's surprising, but it's really not. You know, there aren't that many senatorial families and they're all intertwined. You find a lot of these, perhaps on the face of them, slightly surprising overlaps going on all the time.
So what was Octavius's childhood like then? He enters this household as a four-year-old and really, given his mum's track record, his father's track record, and I guess his stepfather's previous work experience, this is a boy who's going to be raised and groomed to be one of the elites of Rome. You would expect a political life kind of direction for him at some point. So what sort of upbringing does he have?
I guess we always say this about these characters who become famous politicians. They almost always have had the traditional education for an elite Roman. So he's the person in charge of his education is his mother, which is quite normal. He's educated by an enslaved tutor called Spyrus, who's Greek. This is also very typical. Education is often seen as coming from these men with Greek culture. And later on, Artia gets him the finest teachers money can buy. So he's having this extremely good education. And this will bear fruit and is meant to bear fruit in terms of his knowledge of Greek and Roman culture and his ability to speak, we can never overemphasize how essential that is to a politician's progress in Rome. It's really important to be able to engage your peers and the people. It might not have looked like he was going to have certainly a big military career and maybe even not a successful political career, because the two of those are intertwined as well, because he really was ill throughout his childhood and throughout his life. He suffered from, we don't really know. I mean, in the case of Julius Caesar, we're pretty sure it was epilepsy that affected him. Didn't stop him having a successful military and political career. With Octavian, he just seems to have a kind of unnamed illness that affects him at certain important times in his life. And
affects him how, do we know?
We're not even told that. He's just unwell and therefore cannot be in certain places.
Mm.
This will crop up as we go through his life.
Mm.
Now, he lives a very long time, we know, in retrospect, but at the time it might have seemed like, you know, life was not going to necessarily be easy for him, as easy as it should be, given these advantages, because he was bodily quite weak.
Mm. But after a certain point, that's just because he's being poisoned by Livia, isn't it?
Don't say things like that, because people might not be able to distinguish them. Don't you go into Robert Graves' land already.
Interesting note here, which I didn't know, is that he couldn't speak or write Greek.
Well, that's according to Suetonius.
Yeah.
Suetonius says he's interested in Greek culture. Well, he didn't say he couldn't. He was just never fluent. So it was expected that you'd be very good in speaking and writing Greek. Octavian just wasn't his thing, I guess.
He wouldn't have known what Caesar said as his last words.
And he wouldn't have liked it, would he, if he'd known, because he wants to be the heir, not Brutus.
But much like Caesar, his first foray into public life that we get record of was speaking at a funeral and delivering the oration.
Yeah, for his grandmother, Julia. Of course, she's called Julia.
Seems to be quite a big deal for a young Roman to
do. Yeah, and he's very young. He's 11 or 12.
Mm.
This is before he's considered anything like an adult. Okay, he hasn't been through the, you know, you get the toga virilis, the manly toga. That usually happens at 17-ish.
Yeah.
Even though he goes through it a bit early, he's still not at that point. She died in 52 or 51 BCE, so that's how we know when we can age him there. But yep, Suetonius says at the age of 4, he lost his father. We know that already. In his 12th year, he delivered a funeral oration, to the assembled people in honor of his grandmother, Julia. So this is Caesar's sister, Julia Minor.
Mm.
Now, this is a really big public appearance for him, you're right. So it gets him out there very early. It's like, I don't know, putting a child prodigy on stage to play the violin or
like
their mathematics or something.
He's got talent.
Yeah. I wouldn't know.
I've never seen a funeral oration on that, but I haven't watched a lot of the show, to be fair.
Yeah, I don't think it's something we do so much anymore. So it's important for him. It gets his name out there. Presumably he performs reasonably well, even though he can't do it in Greek.
Mm.
And the fact that they allow him to do this suggests that he's already mastering oratory. He does take on the toga virilis, the manly toga, in 48 BCE. Now, again, this is ahead of time. He's only 15. When I said the normal age would be about 17, we know exactly when it was, the 18th of October, 48 BCE. Nicolaus of Damascus, that very kind of laudatory...
Questionable?
Well, kind of toadying biography, says that he's only 14, but as elsewhere, he tends to be dismissed because he exaggerates a lot.
Mm. Rounds down.
Yeah.
So since he's assumed that, then he is a man a lot earlier than he should be. So is he going to just start his career at this point?
Move out, set up in his own little
maybe not that extensive
pad. He certainly doesn't do that, it seems like. And again, we're relying on Nicolaus of Damascus here because Suetonius doesn't go into a lot of detail about this part of his life. But Nicolaus says that Artia maintains control over him. His mother prevented him from going outside of the house, as a quote, except to go where he used to go previously as a boy. And she compelled him to conduct his life as he had before and to sleep in the same room where he previously slept. Only by law was he an adult. In all other respects, he was treated as a boy. I mean, this may be the case. Nicolaus had access to Augustus's own memoirs. It also may be that either Nicolaus or Augustus himself, I should be calling Octavius at this stage, sorry, wanted to convey that his life was entirely respectable at this point. You know, he's not out there carousing every night. He's being kept safe. He's being kept pure by his mother. He even says he didn't change his clothing in any way, so he's not putting on the normal toga every day. And this, I think, is, he may not be putting on the manly toga, but he's putting on Roman dress. Nicolaus is clear about that. And I think he's trying to separate him out from some other Romans like Julius Caesar and Mark Antony, who get criticized by their enemies for wearing foreign dress. He's not going wild and dressing up like a Greek.
Despite this being held back, he does get made a pontifex around this time.
Yeah, he gets made a priest. He's not the big priest. He's not the Pontifex Maximus, but he gets made a unspecified priest to replace Domitius Ahenobarbus. Now, this is also political, though, because Domitius is a major enemy of Caesar's. He had died at Pharsalus, so this had come vacant. So This, you know, this is the big battle in the civil war between Caesar and Pompey. So Caesar must have organized this. He's in charge pretty much at this point. Caesar is Pontifex Maximus at this point. He has been for quite a while. So this is a way of pushing a member of the own family into an important position at a very young age.
Mm. Setting him up and also acknowledging him?
Yeah, well, look, some scholars and some very renowned scholars like Ernst Badian think that this is an acknowledgement that means adoption. But this is controversial and nobody states this anywhere. Spoiler, adoption is going to happen.
Mm.
But is it actually happening at exactly this point? Well, nobody says so. Even Nicolaus can't twist things around to make it an official adoption at this point. It's certainly the first time we get a clear idea that Caesar is interested in promoting Octavius.
So what do we know about the relationship between Caesar and Octavius then? Because this is the very early signs that there is going to be a close association, a close alliance. We know the ending of this story clearly, but we can look back at this as the beginning of Octavius becoming Caesar's heir.
Yeah, we can, but I don't think it would have been absolutely clear to everybody that this was going to be the case.
As I say, we know the ending. We know the in retrospect.
Yeah.
But at the time, this is how you treat your family, I suppose.
Yeah.
If they show promise.
You give them
merit.
A leg up kind of idea.
Yeah.
Yeah. And over the years, it seems to happen very gradually because Caesar's away a lot for one thing, right? In the 50s, he's in Gaul. Then he's quite busy with the civil war. He doesn't get that much time back in Rome. But he was back in Rome when Octavius's father died in 59. Now, remember, Octavius is only 4 at this point. In fact, Caesar was consul that year. So he might well have taken an interest in his welfare at this point. I mean, the welfare of his niece. I mean, he might have been the one trying to arrange the next marriage. Who knows? But the following year, he's off to Gaul. And although he comes back to Italy occasionally, he's got people taking care of his interests back in Rome, but he's not on the spot.
Mm.
He wouldn't be spending time with Octavius. He did spend a few more days, we know of, back in Rome in 49 after crossing the Rubicon, after Pompey had fled Italy. He might have met up with his family then, but it's pretty fleeting through years and years and years through the 50s and the 40s. Nicolaus tells us that Octavius's family were very concerned for his welfare and they sent him off into the country while the civil war was going on. So Artium Philippus sent him to one of his father's country places, says Nicolaus. This seems to be, again, an indication of Artia's protectiveness. So he's hidden away from the action because he's young at this stage.
That's probably a good idea, not only just out of protectiveness, but if you're a close relative of Caesar, you could be at risk.
Yes, yeah. And this protectiveness is seen throughout the biography. And remember, if he's only 19 in 44 when Caesar dies, then in the Civil War, he's in his early teens.
Yeah.
He's very young. He's not even got to that brought forward stage of taking on the manly toga for a lot of this time.
And yet his career still advances.
Minorish roles, I'd say. In April 47 BCE, when he's, 15, he's appointed Praefectus Urbi, the prefect of the city. He's kind of got a caretakerish role, and that is during the Latin festival, he is in charge of public order. And the reason for this is because all the major magistrates of the city and of the Roman state are involved in performing ceremonies, and these take place outside the city. Mm. They go off to the Alban Hills on some kind of junket. No, they're really taking care of important rituals. So it's a kind of honorific. It could be an important caretaker role if something went wrong, but it promotes him. It puts his name up there. He only gets it because of his link to Julius Caesar. Octavius is not the only person to have these privileges because of family connections, by no means at all.
It feels like at some point somebody should actually be doing the job.
Yes. Caesar is back in the city in 46 BCE, though, and this is when things really start to hot up, which is just as well because there's not much time left for Caesar, is there? Yeah, you didn't know that, but we do. Mm. Nicolaus of Damascus tells us that Octavius is seen everywhere with his great uncle at this point. Mm. So right now he's, 17 years old, 16, 17 years old. He's going to dinners, he's going to the theatre, all these public places you can be seen. He's in charge of putting on the plays at the theatre, and Nicolaus is at great pains to tell us that Octavius stays through all of the plays, and it's in the hot summer, so he falls ill. He's ill again. This is the trope that keeps returning. Caesar's very concerned about this and visits him while he's sick. The most public place that he's seen, though, with Caesar is in Caesar's triumph. So this is a huge occasion, this triumphal parade, and he marches right behind Caesar. So Caesar is the triumphant general. And remember, in a triumph, the general is as close to being a god as you're meant to get as a human. Mm. They basically come as a kind of avatar of Jupiter. You know, the painting of the face red is seen to be part of that. And he receives military decorations, even though he had taken no part in the campaign, because he was too unwell.
I was about to say, he's about the right age to be going along on campaigns.
Maybe.
As a, you know, kind of a little boots kind of mascot thing.
Well, he will, but illness will intervene again, as we'll see.
Yeah.
The plan had been for him to go to Africa, but he'd been unwell then with a very serious but, as usual, unspecified illness. Mm. And Artia, according to Nicolaus, had put her foot down, the protectiveness. Artia says, no, you're not well, you're not going. I have to say, though, when Octavius hits 17, there is this impression of a change. This is the typical age for becoming a man. He's had it happen 2 years early for some reason. But at 17, it's as if they say, well, Artia can't really be telling him what to do anymore, or this would make him look a bit weak as a man who's going to be the future princeps, the emperor. So as he's now in charge, he does follow Caesar. He does actively go with Caesar on his Spanish campaign. He'd only recently got over his illness, and Suetonius tells us that it was a hard trip as well. So again, as we'll see, he doesn't actually get active military experience, it seems, but the journey itself was tough. He followed over roads beset by the enemy with only a very few companions, so Suetonius. And that too after suffering shipwreck. And this greatly endeared him to Caesar, who soon formed a high opinion of his character over and above the energy with which he had made the journey. So Suetonius is saying, just turning up, just showing up, made Caesar think a lot of Octavius here.
That's got to be one hell of a journey or a very low bar.
Yeah, well, you always wonder with these biographies, particularly with Nicolaus, but even with Suetonius here, perhaps, whether they're trying to rationalize, you know, there's so little to go on. Mm. We don't know that Octavius took any part in any battles with Caesar. We don't see him, you know, we can talk about the triumph, which is significant. But otherwise, what is it that Caesar saw in Octavius? And I think they don't know, but they know about the will and the adoption, and they're kind of trying to backform reasons for it.
If he was involved in a battle with Caesar, we definitely would have heard about it.
It seems so, because Suetonius and Dio, they talk about him arriving in Spain. They don't talk about him being there at the Battle of Munda in 45 BC in Spain, which is the kind of crucial battle. But instead, they do something which I know is dear to your heart, Matt. They they talk about omens.
Yes. Good. Just as well.
It involves Caesar more than Octavius directly, but they love this story. When Julius Caesar, you know, they're setting up a camp, I think it is. Anyway, they're cutting down trees to either make some fortifications to defend or just camp for the night. And Caesar says, don't cut down that palm tree. It represents victory, the palm of victory. And within a few days, this palm tree has a shoot appearing, which grows so large that it overshadows the original tree. And it's filled with nests of doves. Doves normally don't nest in a palm tree because it's too spiky for them. So, of course, this means that Octavius is going to be greater than his great uncle. What else could it possibly mean?
Oh, that was the very long bow that they drew from
you
that.
You did not see what was the obvious conclusion from this?
No, really not.
You know, omens are always clear as mud. But, again, I feel like, and we shouldn't laugh at and. Well, the way the ancients perceive omens is really significant to them. But what I'd read into this in a kind of literary historical context is there must be some reason. Mm. We don't know exactly what it is. So we're going to manufacture reasons or read additional things into what we know as to why Caesar puts Octavius in his will. We do know that Octavius has influence over Caesar at this point, though. And so that's kind of instructive. And I think this is not something potentially invented by biographers. This is that he successfully petitions Caesar on behalf of Agrippa's brother. So Agrippa, I can't remember if we've mentioned Agrippa before. He's obviously going to be very significant. He's a close friend of Octavius, and he seems to have traveled with him quite a lot. And, you know, Agrippa's going to be really important to him as an advisor and in military contexts.
And a son-in-law.
And a son-in-law, indeed, a long way ahead. Agrippa's brother had fought for the senatorial side in Africa. Nicolaus says that Octavius is very prudent about this, that he chooses the right moment. So he's quite diplomatic. He's got tact. Maybe he's already here demonstrating his shrewd understanding of how to handle those in power, right? You don't come along when they're in a bad mood or, you know, they want to talk about something else. You maybe don't ask for it like you're entitled to it. Say, oh, great Caesar, you know, please would you do me this favor of sparing this man? I know he's good, really. And also, I think this is significant too. When he's in Spain, a certain group of the Spaniards, the Saguntines, they approach Octavius to intercede with Caesar. So they're seeing him as a pathway to Caesar, as somebody who might be their patron, which is pretty good for a 17-year-old, that he's already being seen as someone who might have international clients. So they see his importance as a way to get to the general, the great leader. He's this conduit. So that gives him status. He also gets more status at this point because Julius Caesar promotes him to the patrician brand. I don't know what else to call it at this stage.
Rank?
Rank. Yeah, rank's good. So, you know.
Less cynical.
Being a patrician at this point, and my students always used to think I overrate what being a patrician meant. It had meant an awful lot in the early, maybe mid-Republic, in terms of power you could have, your status. Now it's symbolic. Of course, Caesar is born into it. The Julii are a patrician family, but technically Octavius is from the Octavian family. So he is not born as a patrician. I think this is really significant because that's basically saying you have the same rank as my family. You are in my family. So he's kind of taking him from his paternal family and putting him into this family. He's not giving him the name Julius yet, but he's giving him that rank. This seems really important to me on the way to talking about how Caesar sees Octavius as the next in line, potentially. Now, it's probably important to say that Caesar promoted a lot of other people around the same age to patrician status. So maybe he's got a whole group of people he sees as potential heirs, but Octavius is there.
So we haven't got a lot of runway now between his assassination. So at what point do we think Caesar officially put down Octavius as his heir?
We don't know exactly, but there's a good chance it's in 45 BCE.
So not long before he's
because he dies in the first quarter of 44, doesn't he? Suetonius says that Julius Caesar went to his villa at Lapiki, which is just southeast of Rome, in order to do this. There's a lot of back and forth in Nicolaus on whether this had happened long before, and this is Nicolaus wanting it to be from early on because Octavius was clearly so brilliant from, you know, the moment he appeared in the world. But even he can't actually position it as very early, which suggests to me that that's a lot of flattery. He says, oh, it would have been dangerous if it had been public that Octavius was the heir, which is not impossible.
It's not untrue.
Yeah. Caesar then sends him ahead to Apollonia in Macedonia to study. And that's where he's going to be when Caesar dies. And this is where his friends come in. He goes with his mates. Agrippa, Maecenas, who we're going to talk about a lot later, and a guy called Rufus.
And a guy called Rufus.
We're probably going to talk about Lex.
This sounds like a lad's trip.
It does, doesn't it?
Yeah,
I don't know if we should see it like that. I mean, they do get taught by a top rhetorician, Apollodorus of Pergamum, who had travelled with them from Rome. So I do wonder why they had to go to Apollonia. It was standard to go to Greece to finish your education, as it were, for an elite Roman boy.
Yeah.
It's a bit weird that it's not Athens. A lot of people think it's maybe because five legions were stationed there in Macedonia. So maybe Octavius could take part in army training. It does become significant later, these five legions.
Again, I think you're justifying a lad's trip.
Okay.
I feel that, you know, Sean William Scott would be in this movie.
I don't know who that is.
I don't know which of us is better off then.
Okay, you can tell me later. Anyway, Julius Caesar's got other fish to fry. He's now preparing to attack Dacia, modern Romania. This is not going to be conquered until the time of Trajan, so it's long in the future.
Mm.
And he takes a really important role and gives it to Octavius, at least according to Appian, and that is the role of master of the horse, which is held by Lepidus, who is also a guy who's going to come up more in the near future. So this role of magister equitum, master of the horse, is an important military role, and Octavius really doesn't have much military experience, so it's a bit of a diss for Lepidus, but that is the whole history of Lepidus, as we're going to see. People taking things away from him and not giving him much in return. It is a big role for a very young man. And Dio is clearly shocked by this and says he never really got to take it up, that this was just planned for the future.
Mm.
This is possible because Octavius was still in Macedonia when he hears the news that Caesar has been assassinated. So maybe it was for when he came home.
But it's probably really fortuitous that he was nowhere near Rome when that went down.
Maybe. We could have had a lot of alternate histories if that had happened, eh? Because there is absolute chaos at that. I mean, Rome has been chaotic for years, but
yeah,
much worse now.
Yeah, but if he was there in Rome at the time, he would have very quickly have found himself on a list.
Yeah, well, possibly, and or just, you know, a lot of violence at least, killed in the crossfire, if not something else, if not deliberately taken out. You want to know how he hears the news?
Yes.
The awful news about his great uncle. It came from Artia. She sends one of her freedmen over. So that probably took a little while. He wouldn't have heard immediately. There is some talk of traveling back with the army. So I've said those five legions would come up. But apparently Octavius wanted to, he was being cautious. And we see this throughout. Octavius doesn't just rush into things. And remember, he's a young man. He is 19 years old. But he wanted to test the ground before taking the military option. Because arriving with five legions is making a statement, isn't it? I'm going to take this city by force.
Or I'm going to deal with the people who did this to my great uncle.
Yep.
Mm.
So he needs to find out how popular the assassins are back in Rome. Because you don't know. It could be that the people rise up and celebrate the assassins. It has happened before, especially when tribunes of the plebs have been murdered. So he comes back pretty quietly, arrives in Italy with a few companions. And in Nicolaus's account, at least, this is where he hears about Julius Caesar's will. If you're interested in his teacher, Apollodorus, I know you are, he asks if he can go back to Pergamum, please. I'm very old and I don't want to deal with this stuff.
Wise man.
I think an older teacher deserves to go somewhere a lot quieter and modern Turkey would have seemed like a better place to be at this point.
So this is where he learns that he is the heir to Julius Caesar. The will is brought out and it is read, and it can't have been a total surprise to him, but I'm sure it would have raised a few eyebrows.
Yes, indeed, because even though we've talked about his relationship, both in terms of blood and being marched along in the triumph and things like that, his growing relationship with Caesar, he's not the only one it might have been, all right, who was named as the main heir. He's not the only heir. And we'll talk in our bonus episode about who else was available and who else gets named alongside Octavius, but he is the major heir. And as someone who's very young, this might have seemed surprising to most Romans. The counter to that is Caesar wasn't expecting to die in 44. He's only 56 years old and he's in as good health as he's ever been. So he's probably expecting that Octavius will inherit when he is established as a man, when he's actually seen some military service and gone through some magistracies. All right. So, you know, if it's another 10 or 20 years, he's leaving his estate to a man of 30 or so who's in his prime.
Yeah.
So it would have made more sense.
But now he's leaving his estate to somebody in his late teens who sees that as the go-ahead to take the power as well.
Yeah, he does. But as we'll see next time, he treads carefully. The Senate do not necessarily see this as something that gives him more than, you know, Caesar's villas and so on. Is he someone they can use? Is he someone Mark Antony can use? Who's going to come out on top in the power play here? What we will see is that everyone misjudges Octavius. And we know that. It's easy for us to laugh at this and say it in retrospect because we know that he will come out on top of all of them. He will play them. He will be both lucky and extremely clever.
That was Dr. Rhiannon Evans, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. We are a listener-supported podcast, so thanks to everyone who has given their support on Patreon. As part of the perks, our Patreon members get bonus episodes. We recently looked at the other potential heirs of Julius Caesar, and here's a clip. That's a strange one because, you know, given his position, his power, that he was a close ally, you would think that that is a very obvious heir.
Yes. And also he has male children himself. We know of at least three.
And he's got the name.
He's got the name. You can inherit the name. Certainly Octavius does that. You
know, saves the paperwork. It's right there.
Well, he's Lucius, not Gaius, I suppose. He does have a Gaius as a child. Such a common name.
Though. Yes, yeah.
And he does survive Caesar. No, Caesar doesn't know this is going to be the case. They're broadly the same age, presumably. He has at least three sons, possibly four. Lucius, a Gaius, and a Sextus. But they're all completely ignored in Caesar's will.
Interesting.
So may as well have not talked about them, really. But they were out there, and this guy had been by Caesar's side.
Yeah. You can find out more at patreon.com/Rome podcast. This podcast has been recorded and produced in Melbourne, Australia, on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people. So until the next episode, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.